Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
It's time for Micro Brew, the newest edition of the Milwaukee Brewers, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel podcast. My name is J.R. Radcliffe. On the other line is Kurt Hoge, Brewers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And folks, it's time to panic a little bit. I mean, panic's probably too strong. The Brewers actually gained a half game in the standings if we're looking at the weekend total on the struggling St. Louis Cardinals. They're still up 2.5 in first place, but they just had one of the most dispiriting weeks of baseball in recent memory. And that includes, I would include that with some weeks here during their losing streak when they had one-win weeks. I believe back-to-back one-win weeks. They had six games all at home against the Cubs and Pirates. They lost four of them, realistically should have lost five of them, and nearly lost all of them, and gave away a couple, or maybe not gave away, but did not have any offensive flash. It's looked, the Brewers, it's looked bad at times, it's looked fine at times, but this was not a good one, and so we are here to talk about it. Kurt, we'll, I don't know where I want to start, I guess. I mean, this is the problem with a baseball season. We've talked about this before. The Brewers just had a really terrible week. Honestly, I think it was a terrible week of baseball, but they are still even in better position than they were going into the week in terms of the standings. You know, they could certainly still survive this. They've done better on the road than at home at this point. So going on the road for six games before the All-Star break doesn't even feel like a punishment or anything. Part of me just wants to say straight up, this team is really been pretty bad as a first place team can be. The other part of me is like, well, they're a first place team, so how much can we really complain? Straighten me out here, Kurt. Tell me what I should be feeling about this baseball team.
Yeah, that was not a good week. The main concern I would have from this week, not to jump right off the bat with doom, here's the concern you should have, but like, the Cardinals are not going to play that bad very often, right? I mean, you kind of had your chance there to bump that lead up to five games, four games, six games, whatever it may be, and you're not going to get a whole lot of 5 out of 6 or 6 out of 7 losses from the Cardinals.
Yeah, 8 of 10 going into Sunday where they shut it down. You know, they were able to win a one-run game, but it's been ugly for St. Louis, and the Brewers have not been able to pull away.
Yeah, I guess the glass half full is like it could have been worse. Like, you could have played like the Cardinals did, and I'm sure their fans were going even more nuts. Actually, I know they were going even more nuts than Brewers fans were, just judging off of Twitter from the last few days, although things were not going well on either side of the spectrum.
Yeah, I guess if I'm a Brewers fan, I'm concerned for a couple reasons. One is, you know, if you look at this playoff format, we've talked about how it's so much easier to get in, and that's true. But it's also much more incumbent to be one of those two teams with the top two records because you get that first round bye. Otherwise, your season comes down to a best of three. Right now, the Brewers are not close to bypassing either the Dodgers or the Mets. Now, I don't think it's necessarily even realistic to expect them to pass the Dodgers, but you'd like to think they could linger close to the Mets. So it isn't even if you can say to yourself they're still in good playoff position. And while that is true right now, it's, you know, obviously not a guarantee, but they're not really putting them, they're really falling further behind here in the race for one of those playoff spots. The other thing is, you know, I think a lot of people are sort of spinning their wheels, understanding that at the end of July, beginning of August, the Brewers will probably add some pieces. They'll probably add a center fielder. They'll probably add a couple bats if they can, maybe a bullpen guy, maybe even a starter. I don't know. But you look at this roster, and we've also touched on this before. What are they going to add that's going to make them markedly better? I mean, yeah, adding a center fielder, let's say they get the best guy they possibly can. Let's say they get like Cedric Mullins or Brian Reynolds or something, which is a heavy ask, and I'm not sure they have the pieces to do something like that. Is that going to really change things dramatically for them? I mean, I just don't think it is. I think so much of what they have is baked into, you know, they have their guys at all these different positions. They have their guys in the bullpen who had a rough week. You know, the starters, Brandon Woodruff and Corbin Burns are giving you everything they got. You know, two tremendous starts from those guys this weekend. Both of them were washed away in one case because the Brewers wouldn't score any runs, and in another because the bullpen blew a three-run lead. So, like, this is the panic you feel if you are thinking about this team as a playoff team. They are just not looking like a team that can be better than last year's team, which didn't have the offense in the postseason and then had a couple, you know, bullpen hiccups that you know, took care of the rest. Like, it's just so hard to envision this team doing anything in the postseason, even though other teams at this level have. It's just, you know, these are just all the things floating around my head if I'm watching this team right now, Kurt.
Well, that was impassioned. I think we began with a question about the trade deadline, and then we went into, like, a wholesale.
Yeah,
wholesale.
Okay, so you're right. Let's focus on that. The trade deadline isn't far away. Presumably, David Stearns is working the phones. You know, we haven't seen a lot of action across baseball. The Brewers are included in that, obviously. No deals yet. But I don't imagine they have what it takes to get a superstar upgrade. I don't know if there are any superstar upgrades to have. And I don't think this team can get a lot better at the trade deadline. I think there's a ceiling to what they can achieve. Maybe I'm wrong about that, though. What do you think about that?
Well, I think they have the guys if they want to go get someone. The thing is, I don't know if they want – I just don't think it's – they want to pay that price for a cost-controlled multiple-year center fielder, which would be Reynolds and Mullins. And outside of that, the center field market's kind of thin, I guess. Like, you're looking sort of like Michael A. Taylor sort of guys.
That's like a defensive guy.
Unless you get creative / weird, and then you're like putting Ian Happ, who the Cubs would never trade to the Brewers anyway, or Andrew Benintendi in center, and I don't know if that's exactly what you want to do either. So, I mean, it feels like they have to add a center fielder. Their outfield depth is very thin. You know, you see one injury to Hunter Renfroe, already knocked that down significantly, and then another one to Tyrone Taylor, and now they're playing Jace Peterson and Keston here in the outfield every day, which both have been good bats, but like, if that's where that's the guys you have to play in the outfield, you're missing you're clearly missing some guys. So the short point of this long-winded answer, I guess, is that they have the guys to get the guys. But I don't know, until proven otherwise, I'm going to assume the Brewers will make a couple, like, especially under the Stearns front office regime, they'll make a couple sneaky, you know, counterintuitive, but counter to what you would expect moves. That's pretty much been the MO every trade deadline. But then you're also juxtaposing that with the feeling like they got to get a center fielder, right?
Yeah. Okay, let's dig a little deeper on the guys to get the guys. I'm kind of curious who you think are those guys. We'll talk more about Jackson Chourio a little bit later on here. He kind of had a week where his profile, I would say, didn't blow up or anything. It's been high in Brewer circles for a while. But, you know, I think there's more and more momentum toward people understanding how special he could be. Below that, I'm not sure there are some guys that, you know, there's like recent top draft picks, and there's Bryce Terang, Sal Frelick, Ethan Small, you know, guys that Brewers fans can be kind of excited about, but those are not prospects that you part with to get a true frontline upgrade. And then I look at the major league roster and you know, like, I kind of had this epiphany this week that I shared with you, Keston Hira, who is kind of an interesting guy, still strikes out a ton, but has actually pretty good offensive numbers at this point. No true defensive home. Maybe he is a guy that the Brewers discuss trading. You know, on the other hand, he's still young and controllable years left. I mean, that's a pretty, it's a commodity that, you know, probably they wouldn't be selling him high necessarily, but higher than he's been. So maybe that's a guy. Pedro Severino, of course, is on this team now. So they got three catchers. That's a lot. What do you think the Brewers would be willing to part with? And maybe, are any of these guys, is that even, like, too much? Like, last year, a lot of deals went down for like, you know, the number 12 prospect in the organization, for example. Like, maybe I'm overrating what they would need to part with in order to get a major upgrade.
Yeah, I mean, to get, like, the Brian Reynolds or the Mullins, you know, the kind of guys that teams don't have to part with, it's going to have to be a Weimer, Frelick, Chourio, although I don't think they have any desire to trade Chourio with just the ceiling that young man has. I mean, he's got legitimate, like, top prospect in baseball ceiling at some point. Just kind of looking at the path ahead for him. But nonetheless, I mean, it's a deeper system now. than it was even a couple of years ago. I mean, guys like Jefferson Caro, Henry Mendez, sort of the lower level international amateur signings that kind of have some ceiling there. Ethan Small is he's, you know, much closer to the big leagues as a pitcher. That's always a valuable asset. I don't know which ones they're, it's impossible to predict who they would have to part ways with, and impossible to say who they don't want to part ways with. But the thing about this system is they do have a pool of like 10 to 20 players. You look at it like, okay, that I legitimately could see that player's, you know, expected outcome to be a big league player. Now it's just a question of who are they getting in return and what do they want to part with? Because like I said, if it's one of those bigger names, you're looking at Frelick and Churio probably are kind of the two in my mind that are like, it's got to be a very special package to move either of them somewhere. And I think the other guys are all maybe their stocks are a little more in the middle.
Yeah, Jackson Churio is not going anywhere, first of all. I wanted to be clear that I don't think there's any scenario where they trade him. I can't even imagine a scenario where they trade him. Looking at this team sort of facet by facet, we'll start with the offense. You know, we have operated under a lot of assumption that the offense hasn't been holding up its end of the deal all season long. Certainly there are examples of that this week. The loss to the Cubs comes to mind, the middle loss. This is the first of the two losses because the offense just simply, you know, couldn't generate anything. Wound up losing a Corbin Burns start 2-1. You had written though recently or had tweeted that they actually offensively, you know, as OPS plus goes, which compares your offense to the rest of the league, is still enough above average to be the best offense of the David Stearns era, dating back to when his first full year with the Brewers in 2016. So, and actually since then, the OPS has gone up. OPS plus has gone up to 105, which I realize most people, you know, they don't have a calculus in their head for how that works, but that's, you know, roughly 5% above the average Major League Baseball offense. That's not terrible. And in fact, if you go back and look at some recent World Series winning teams, you've got, for example, the 2010 Giants, the 2006 Cardinals, the 01 Diamondbacks, if you want to go back, you know, a couple decades. There are teams out there, the 2015 Royals, there are teams out there that have won with much worse offenses. It is possible to win a World Series without an offense. So this is a long way of asking, are we wrong about the offense? Is the offense actually better than we think it is? Or is there more to it? I think the numbers are also a little misleading too. So how would you answer that?
Yeah, I don't think you want to get too far away from like what you've seen, and that there's some danger with that once you start getting into like, well, you know, my eyes tell me they're terrible with runners in scoring position when in actuality they're pretty good with runners in scoring position. The problem is just they don't get runners in scoring position enough. But the aggregate does look favorable, but do they pass like the, I don't really want to call it the eye test, but like when you stack this lineup up and down, you look at the consistency of production, you know, week in, week out, game in, game out, do they avoid those really bad lulls? Are they a steady offense that produces against good teams? And that's not exactly what they are. I mean, they've mashed a bunch against like the Reds and the Pirates. As we learned this week, when you lose against the Pirates and Cubs, those games count. When you win those games, they also count. But if you are trying to find like that top end, that top third of the league offense, that's just not what this team is. And part of that is they just don't have the guys at the very top. It's a very deep lineup, and that has its benefits as well. I mean, they're throwing out, you know, lineups where Keston here is hitting eighth, and like you just talked about, he's been statistically one of their better hitters despite striking out a ton still. So it's deep. Some of these past like Stearns era lineups were weighed down by really bad production from guys that played like the entire season, like some of the Arcia rough offensive seasons, or like when Travis Shaw struggled or Aguilar or whatnot. And they don't really have that. I mean, Lorenzo Cain was DFA'd and he was the guy kind of at the bottom of the poll there. So it's deep. which in theory limits the floor, but like they've been shut out as much as most teams. So it's super cool that we're like at the All-Star break and still wondering what exactly the offense is, which leads me to say it is what you see. And what do you see is it's okay.
Yeah, often we can poo-poo the, well, they're good against bad teams, bad against good teams that you see early in the season. You can sort of root it out as a sample issue. The further we've gone into the season, the more that's been kind of borne out to be accurate. And somewhat, I guess, paradoxically, this week sort of, you know, puts cold water on that because they went up against two very bad teams in the Cubs and Pirates. I shouldn't say very bad for Pittsburgh, maybe, but they were able to, their offense, you know, was mostly mediocre this week. Again, at home. At home, they're just a couple games above 500, which I find to be kind of interesting. Okay, that's the offense. Defensively, what do you look at when you're assessing a team defensively? Because the eye test tells me this team has not been good defensively. Certainly, they've had their major problems in left field. You know, Christian Yelich, I think we could just say it, he's not a great defensive player. His arm is not very strong. Keston Hiura, when he's out there, that's, you know, not their first choice. Also not a very strong arm. I mean, this is a guy whose arm was going to be an issue on the infield. Certainly that's the case in the outfield. You know, we saw a couple interesting throws from the outfield this week. And infield-wise, Jace Peterson, I think, is pretty reliable. I'd say he's very reliable. If you look at WAR, he's very reliable. And then Willy Adames is fine. Colton Wong has been much below his standards this year at second base defensively. And Rowdy Tellez is, you know, I think I don't know if you'd say liability, but if you look at some of the defensive metrics, at best, he's you know, a subpar defender. Catching's been good. So, like, is this a good defensive team, an average defensive team? Some stats would tell you they're even a little bit better than average, which I don't know if I believe, but it depends what stats you consult. So how do you assess this team defensively?
Yeah, there's a million different defensive metrics telling you a bevy of different things. I do like to use those as reference, especially with, you know, I think sometimes they do shed some good insight. Like with Jace Peterson, it tells you how really, really good he's been at third base, despite, like, he's not flashy, but he just makes a bunch of plays. But the thing that keeps coming back to my mind is just the critical mistakes that cost them games, essentially. I mean, there's many things in the game that cost you a game. It's not just a one-off thing, but I mean, you look again, like at Sunday's game, Pedro Severino doesn't catch a ball, leads to a pass ball, run scores that otherwise wouldn't have scored. And that changes the way the game is played the rest of the way. Instead of it being tied in the late innings, the Brewers kind of brought out their B team bullpen, which is another thing we could talk about is the bullpen has been shaky, and they are very clearly a team that's built to not blow leads. Like
they, oh, that's they on my leads, list, Kurt. That's on my
we'll
list.
We'll get there. Okay. We'll get, so we'll touch on that. But it just, I mean, it's just, there's dozens of other games that I can't think of off the top of my head because there's many games in the baseball season, but like just lots of mistakes and these close losses defensively that come back to bite you. Some of them's not, and sometimes it's maybe even not close losses. It's like that Cubs game on Tuesday, I believe, where they threw the ball around a bunch, and it's just not the markings or the makings of a good defensive team. I think you tend to, like, you have a bias where you know those bad plays that cost the team stand out, and you kind of overlook some of the good. Like on Monday, you know, there was a Willy Adames backhanded diving play to keep the Cubs off the board as you know the Brewers were trying to come back late. So there is certainly the good, and we do overlook that, but like it's kind of the same with the offense. You know, don't deny what you're seeing if it's overwhelming.
Okay, the bullpen, you know, you're right, and actually Sunday is a great example because Trevor Gott gives up the lead. Trevor Gott's been still okay, but not maybe as flashy as he was to start the year. And the Brewers are leading 4-3. He gives up a couple home runs. It's 5-4. Now, if you have the lead held on to there, you don't go to Chichi Gonzalez in the eighth inning. He gives up three runs. You know, of course, to Daniel Vogelbach, who seems to be playing very well against this old team. He hits the big home run, and now it's Now it's an 8-4 game. Andrew McCutchen hits a 2-run homer off the Pirates closer, David Bednar, all-star closer. So, like, you figure those runs, you know, in the circumstance where you have the lead, they happen anyway. The Brewers come back and win. But instead, because they went to sort of the second tier of their bullpen, you know, they gave up a few extra runs that wound up biting them. That's not the first time that's happened this year to the Brewers. And it does sort of illustrate the gulf between your, you know, sort of ace bullpen guys, meeting Josh Hader, Devin Williams, maybe Brad Boxberger prior to this week, but versus the other guys. Now, you're going to expect a gulf. You know, not everybody in the bullpen is going to be a stud closer, stud setup guy, and we get that. But it does seem like the bullpen has faltered a lot lately, especially this week. And Josh Hader is in a little bit of a lull right now by his standards. So, you know, you did have a little bit of action against him this week. He took a loss against the Cubs, for example. He almost took a loss in a game that was pretty exciting against the Pirates on Friday night. And Brad Boxberger, who you wrote about at jsonline.com, you know, has been very steady and I think is a very good pitcher. But he's also got a little bit of luck on his side, and that maybe came back to earth a little bit during a couple outings this week. So what do we say about the bullpen? Is it a good bullpen? Like, I truly don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, I mean, it still is on, if for no reason other than you have Devin Williams and Josh Hader going 8-9. I don't want to say the bullpen so much was exposed because, you know, like, bullpens are going to have down weeks. That's absolutely just the course of a baseball season. But I think sort of like the reliance on them was exposed. I mean, that loss Saturday, you know, you don't get any tack on runs, really. You get 3 runs off the Pirates, and like, you can't expect 3 runs to be, you know, to win you a ton of games. And all of a sudden, you know, Brad Boxberger has a blip. Is the same thing as when they led 1-0 going into the 8th inning on Wednesday. Brad Boxberger has a blip, game's tied. Josh Hader has a tiny blip. Oh, you lost. And then, you know, Sunday, Trevor Gott has a rough inning. And then it felt like, you know, it felt like that 5-4 score would have held up for the Pirates. It ended up that Chichi Gonzalez 3-run homer ended up being a big deal. But yeah, it's one thing we could talk about is not using Devin Williams or Josh Hader in any situation other than when they're winning or tied. Like Sunday, they probably could have gone to either in the ninth. And I'm curious to hear, you know, what your thoughts are on kind of that situation, because you're playing it by the numbers, right? But sometimes does the situation call for you to go against those and put one of them in? And it's a season long deal of managing a bullpen that's very difficult.
Yeah, I don't, I mean, we've talked about this before. I mean, I go a couple ways. There are times where I feel like, yes, Craig Counsell elects to stay away from those guys in close games when the game is still very winnable. I also know that the more usage you get, especially out of Josh Hader, because we've seen this before, if his usage goes way up, you know, he's not as effective. And so you want to keep him as fresh as possible because you want to be comfortable that in the ninth inning, you've got a guy who can just absolutely, you know, lay the hammer down and end things. And right now that's the way it's going in the eighth too with Devin Williams. So that, I'll be honest, that did not occur to me on Sunday that was something that he definitely should have done. Just as it didn't occur to me on Saturday when he went to Yandel Gustave late in the game, with Hader warming up about the same time. So like I don't mind that in the context of this long season. I don't mind that, especially because they are still comfortable is too strong a word, but like, they're still leading the division. You know, they don't have to panic about any of these individual games. I think my concern would be, are there enough guys in that bullpen that can handle that workload and consistently deliver, even if they're not in high leverage situations or the highest level situations? I'm not sure the Brewers, you know, could say right now, who pitches the sixth inning when you get 5 good innings out of a starter? You know, who's the sixth inning guy right now? It could be, you know, it's a crapshoot a little bit. I mean, I guess Trevor Gott, but I don't know if I feel like the Brewers have really the depth that they could truly count on beyond their big two at the back of the bullpen.
Yeah, the depth is definitely what has to be addressed at the deadline, and I feel like it will be. I mean, the Brewers almost guaranteed every season will bring in one, if not two, kind of middle inning to high leverage guys, and, you know, hope they turn out. Sometimes they turn into Drew Pomeranz, and sometimes they turn into Daniel Norris, and that's the beauty of the The reliever deadline trade roulette. So
perfect analogy. No, perfect analogy.
And I get the decision. You know, it's off speaking about Sunday's game to you know, there's what 85-90% chance you're going to lose that game if you just look at win probability down by one run going into the eighth or the ninth. I get it. I just think that sometimes, you know, you got the off day Monday. You just had an off day Thursday.
Sure.
You know, why not? And we don't know the behind the scenes workings of, you know, if some guys are sore or whatnot. Craig Counsell did say after the game it was workload was the reason he stayed away from Hader and Williams, down the stretch. Even though Williams has pitched, I think, once since Monday, which makes me wonder if something else is going on there. But we have no way of knowing that. So it just could have been a spot maybe where you say, okay, let's try to win this game. But on the aggregate, you know, it seems to be a strategy that works pretty well, and there's math behind it. And I'm sure this is something that, you know, the whole organization has looked into, and there's analytics and numbers and whatnot behind it. But sometimes maybe bucking the trends every now and again isn't the worst thing.
Yeah. All right. Before we get to three up, three down, Jackson Churio is a name that we mentioned earlier on this podcast. He is, MLB.com updated its prospect rankings this week. He moved up significantly. He's now the number one prospect in the Brewers organization. Baseball America didn't quite go that far, but everyone who sees this guy raves about him. He is in Single A, Carolina, and he's a young 18 years old. He's the youngest player in that league. And so obviously there's, you know, that's a major caveat, but the guy, the numbers that he's putting up are comparable to other 18-year-olds who are some very, very big names in baseball when they were at that level. We're talking Mike Trout, Bryce Harper, you know, Guerrero, like we're talking about the best of the best here. So understandably, Brewers fans are getting very, very excited about this guy. He continues to mash homers. He is seemingly, you know, just, you know, I don't know if he's going to end up at Wisconsin by the end of the year. They may choose to just kind of keep him down at Single A, protect him for the duration of the year. But I bet he'll be with the Timber Rattlers soon enough, and that's going to skyrocket his profile even more among Brewers fans, and maybe the scouting community at large. You did a story on Churio this week. You know, obviously people can go read that at jsonline.com. What do you want people to know about him? What are your takeaways from talking to him and writing about him, and what other people are saying about him?
It's my big takeaway from talking to him is just how supremely confident he is. I mean, he didn't shy away from any expectations or, you know, wanting to play in the big leagues or be promoted this year or even play in Biloxi this year. You know, like he, I don't know if he wants the smoke is like the right term, but he wants the smoke. He's a gamer. He's a competitor. And not only that, but like you watch him and oh my goodness, that swing is violent. He wants to inflict damage on the ball. Yet it doesn't feel like, you know, a lot of young prospects have like very violent, heavy swings, you know, especially like guys that coming out of, you know, signed at 16 or coming out of high school or whatnot. Like it's often like a raw profile. And you see some of that with him, like the strikeout stuff is high, but it's not outrageous for an 18-year-old playing full season ball against, you know, pitchers that average like 21, 22 years old for the first time. So the production, when you see it stacked up against the other guys, like you mentioned, the Trouts, Harpers, Vladdy Juniors, Acuna, I think is up there as well. Like you don't want to jump the gun on a guy, especially an 18-year-old prospect. But the fact that, I mean, like the top eight guys that have produced like this at that age, at that level, the fact that they are who they are kind of makes it feel like there could be something legitimate here. And you know, you kind of look at some of the top prospects, like the paths that they take to becoming like the top, you know, one of the top three prospects in baseball. A lot of it is young kids who outperformed their age by such a significant margin and just kept doing that and showed lots of tools, and he's got lots of tools. So yeah, I don't remember what the initial question is, but there's a lot there, JR.
The initial question is Jackson Chourio. That's the question and the answer. And Brewers fans dreaming big. Dreaming big that this isn't just a top prospect, but maybe like a future superstar. At 18, it's hard to say, but like it feels right at this point.
Yeah, and it's good to end what was definitely not a good week of big league baseball with some, you know, the evergreen promise of the next prospect, which the Brewers have not excelled or even done average or slightly below average at developing bats. They've been very, very poor at it over the last decade or so. So that's a trend that they're hoping they can snap with this current flock of young kids.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I'm old now. Now that I refer to prospects as young kids.
Yes, they are actually younger than you. So that's a different vibe for you. Okay, hey, let's go right to three up, three down. I'm going to start. Speaking of bright spots, this Monday game, it's true that the Brewers should have lost this game. I'm not quite sure how they did not. But Monday, you could probably spend a whole 30 minutes talking about just the events of that game. Victor Caratini's walk-off home run. Again, Victor Caratini, what a... the Brewers got him out of desperation. I can't imagine they expected him to be this important of a player to them. He's not a full-time guy, but wow, has he been great this year. This game had a lot. It's a walk-off victory for the Brewers, an extra innings. You've got the Brad Boxberger escape. It wasn't a great week for him, but he had that tremendous escape. Not the first time that they've had a runner at third with nobody out in a big spot, and Boxberger has gotten away against the Cubs, actually gotten away without allowing that run. You had the Adames play. You briefly mentioned that a play in the hole that saved a run, a very smooth defensive effort. And then Pedro Severino with his first RBI for the Milwaukee Brewers had a double that tied the game late inning, seventh inning, I want to say, when it was just a 1-1 game. So a lot of craziness. Christian Yelich's bases loaded walk down to their last out, and then the Caratini walk-off homer. Truly a magnificent game for those who attended. Unfortunately, you wouldn't expect the week to go so south after such an uplifting stolen victory, but you gotta tip your cap to that Monday game. That was pretty exciting.
Yeah, and I think the craziest thing, you know, out of that game, there was a bunch of stats going around. It was like the first game with a leadoff homer, or not a leadoff homer, a first career homer, walk-off homer, and inside the park homer. The craziest thing, and there's a bunch of stuff like that, but the craziest thing was the go-ahead inside the park homer in the ninth. Like, that's just...
incredible.
I'll probably never see that again. Like, that's just a one-off sort of weird baseball thing.
Yeah, that against Josh Hader. Saya Suzuki hit a ball Davis misplayed a little bit. Well, not misplayed, but he maybe wasn't ready for the way it was going to bounce off that center field wall.
Ho-hum, just inside the park homer off the best closer in baseball. Speaking of best closer in baseball, Hader and Burns were named All-Stars, which, I mean, you know, that's definitely congratulations to those guys. They earn it. They're arguably the best at their positions in baseball. But what I wanted to talk about was I think Devin Williams got a little bit of a snubby snub. Joe Mantiply, Diamondbacks reliever, seemed to be like the only non, you know, big name closer to get a nod. And sometimes it is very difficult for setup guys to get an All-Star nod, especially right off the bat without being, you know, a replacement for an injured guy or a guy who pitches on the Sunday right before and is unavailable. But I feel like Devin, even though his ERA may not have been, you know, it's very good, it's sub two, it may not have been the eye-popping like 0.5 or something that sometimes you feel like these guys need. It just feels like he deserved it, not only being like the best setup man in baseball, but the underlying numbers are even better than his actual performance has been. He's gotten a little unlucky. He's saved games when Hader's out, and like he would close on any other team. So I'm curious to see if he makes it in as a replacement. If not, I think was definitely, you know, he's probably the next most deserving reliever that didn't get selected.
Yeah, I initially obviously was surprised that he wasn't in, but not too much. You know, the guys I looked at, Joe Mantiply, his numbers are as good, if not a little better. When you look at the overall, you know, Devin had some shaky outings early in the season that have inflated his overall numbers from how good he's been lately. But he's also, Mantiply is the only Diamondbacks representative. David Bednar of the Pirates, the only representative. You know, he's got to be the one to go. And then, you know, maybe Ryan Helsley, I thought, and then I looked at his numbers and they're incredible. They're just insane. I mean, he hasn't been closing all year. I don't think he only has six saves, probably seven if he got the save today. But, you know, he's got to be there too, I think. So, like, I came away looking through all that and thinking, probably makes sense. Now Devin Williams, as people who follow the All-Star game know, could easily go. A lot, like you said, a lot of pitchers don't get selected, you know, end up bowing out for any number of reasons. I think that there's an open-mindedness about setup guys more than there used to be. I think there's a good chance he still gets in, but there are other people who are on that line too. So we'll see how that goes. With the Brewers already having two representatives, I don't know if they'll be first in line or anything like that. But yes, I forgot to talk about the All-Stars. That was going to be the first thing we talked about, and I just got lost in all the other stuff. So my bad. Thanks for bringing that up, man. Another my number two in my three up, three down is the Friday night out at home. A crazy finish again against Josh Hader. The Pirates with a very unusual decision to send Kevin Newman home on a single from Daniel Vogelbach. Runners were at the corners, two outs. One run scores, of course, to make it a 4-3 game. The send of Newman, he's thrown out by a mile. Willy Adames had a full pause, thinking there's no way the guy's going to run, and then took the relay from McCutchen, threw it home, and was able to get the last out at the plate. Very exciting way to finish a game, to have the last out at the plate, although it was a head-scratching decision by the Pirates. Still, bailed out the Brewers a little bit, you know? That helps them win that one-run game. Otherwise, the tying run is at third base with two outs. Again, this is Josh Hader struggling a little bit by his standards this week, and the Brewers were, I think, kind of fortunate to come away with that one clean, but they do get that win 4-3. You know, the walk-off hit, walk-off play at the plate, those are your two wins for the week. That's pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah, I was pretty confused during that inning how the home plate umpire, there was, I think it was before Kevin Newman singled, he had like a little cue shot, and it was clearly on the chalk when Victor Caratini picked it up and he called it foul. I was fairly confused as to how that decision was made, and it almost loomed large if the Pirates let, you know, keep Newman at third and let Brian Reynolds would have been the next hitter. That would have been some high drama. So I'll go back to Wednesday. Keston Hiura's catch,
yes.
Getting his second career start in left field, second career start, I believe, overall in the outfield ever. And he saves a run in a 1-0, or no, it was a 0-0 game at that point. Keeps Corbin Burns out of a little bit of trouble by smashing his face into the chain link fence as he made a grab on a kind of a weird line drive off the bat of PJ Higgins that he kind of just reached out and poked, and it kept carrying and kind of tricked everybody until all of a sudden Hiura is, you know, he's mouth to mouth with the wall, and he has the ball on his glove. And he even said after that, he thought he had another step on the warning track, which would make sense as to why he had no idea that it was almost like if you put someone in outfield that's never played baseball before and you tell them they can only look forward, so that he just had like no idea there's a wall there. He's just going to make a nice running catch and then smack face first. Yeah. It was a really impressive play.
It was. And then, of course, his at bat the following inning, later that half inning, is a long, I want to say, 9-pitch at bat. Then he hits a titanic home run to give the Brewers a 1-0 lead. So he goes from an amazing faceplant catch in left field to the home run. Unfortunately, it doesn't hold up, and the Brewers wind up losing that game. But for the moment, Keston Hiura, you know, again, we talked about it. It's a puzzle player for me, because you look at that strikeout rate in the 40s. Like, it's just so unsustainable. He's not going to be producing offensively if that continues to be his strikeout rate. And yet, I would say that over the last couple weeks, I've been more comfortable watching, you know, thinking he's going to come through at the plate than anybody in this lineup. You know, he's got a fair number of key hits. He seems to be a little bit more comfortable than he has been in the past. And yeah, he's going to swing and miss a ton. He's got decent on base percentage. Like, he's offensively, this is decent for him. And either it's going to go south, and like I said, maybe it's the right time to trade him, or he's going to be able to lower that strikeout rate. I don't know where this goes from here, but it's an interesting situation with Keston Hiura.
Yeah, that was going to be quite the easy game, you know, game narrative to write from that Wednesday game. And then the Cubs had other plans.
Yeah, very unfortunate situation there. My number three is something Brandon Woodruff and Corbin Burns are dealing. That's three straight starts off the IL for Brandon Woodruff, where he has looked absolutely sensational. And Corbin Burnes is just doing Corbin Burnes things. I mean, he is probably not your front runner for Cy Young. I would say definitely not, as long as Sandy Alcantara is still healthy and doing what he's doing. So Burnes, though, top three guy, you know, in the NL. Once again, he's gonna finish way up there if things stay as they are. And this leads me to a little bit of a hot take. I wonder if the Brewers will put all of their resources on the trade deadline toward getting a starting pitcher. Because if you look at the postseason, it would be a best of three situation. You could maybe say to yourself, Brewers are probably not going to get one of those top two records. They're almost certainly going to be in a best of three situation. Put Burnes next to Woodruff, next to whoever you can get that you can rely on in that situation. That greatly enhances your odds to win in that series and the next one. And then, you know, you've got guys like Ashby, Peralta, and Hauser, all of whom have been hurt this year at points in time, who I think would all make excellent multi-inning relief options. Gotten good news on Peralta. He's probably going to be back in August, or at least that seems like how everybody feels like it's going to happen. You know, I think that is something that the Brewers could potentially pursue. I don't have any idea what David Stearns is actually going to do, but I know it's seldom the thing we think he's obviously going to do, as you said earlier. So that's my hot take, that I think maybe there's a starting pitcher and not a center fielder that's going to be the focus of this trade deadline.
Well, yeah, you kind of, it's kind of fun to think of, like, what if they got, you know, Luis Castillo or some other frontline pitcher like Frankie Montas. I think the issue is this year's starting pitching trade market is very thin, like in terms of top tier guys. So which means they'll end up like getting Jordan Lyles for a third go around.
Jordan Lyles, yes.
It is kind of fun to think like, oh, you know, they could feasibly bring out a rotation of Burnes, Woodruff, Frankie Montas, and then have wild card Freddie Peralta, wild card Aaron Ashby, in like a hybrid bullpen role, the role that at this point Ashby is probably best in. I think the Brewers would prefer to use him in if they weren't so depleted. So that's kind of a fun image to think about. I mean, they are already probably, you know, if they get Freddie back, are going to have as good of a playoff rotation as anyone, and that would only take them to the next level instead of sort of playing, you know, I said roulette with the relievers, sort of roulette with like a bat too. Like, what are they going to do over a 2 month stretch? Basically, are they going to go bananas, or is it going to kind of flop like Jonathan Scope did? So, this will be very interesting to see. And then, I mean, this actually ties perfectly into my third chair. So well done by you, inadvertently here. Jose Quintana is one of those names the market almost surely will be traded by the Pirates. I mean, they have to trade him, right? Like, he's pitching pretty well. He's on an expiring deal. Now, I don't think the Brewers trade for him. That's not what I'm saying here. But it's just a good segue to point out the fact that they hit Jose Quintana on Sunday.
And yes.
Pigs did not fly.
No, but the Brewers also did not win, so it feels a little bit hollow, but it is true.
It's absolutely hollow because they didn't win, but it was just I couldn't get through this podcast without mentioning the fact that Jose Quintana pitched against the Brewers, and he did not get through the fifth inning, and he gave up four runs. It just felt so weird. It was like after the first inning, I don't think they touched him at all, and then it was just thinking, oh, yeah, this is a Jose Quintana start, isn't it? And it turned out to not be. Put four runs on him. I think he got four and a third, and then the bullpen shut him down from there. But the Brewers hit Jose Quintana, JR.
Yes, the Brewers should hopefully get a little bit of help back against left-handed pitchers with both Hunter Renfroe and Tyrone Taylor due back at some point here in this last stretch of games before the All-Star break. I think everybody was pointing to that San Francisco series, the four-game series that starts on Thursday as the probable return for those guys. This offense is a lot better when Hunter Renfroe is in it, so that's a pretty valuable guy to have back, and then we'll see what comes after the All-Star break. Kurt, if that's it, let's move into Remember When.
Yeah, let's do it.
Red Hot Memories, High School Beat.
A couple reasons why I'm bringing this up. First of all, there was a walk-off homer this week for the Brewers, which always gives me a chance to update my walk-off database that I'm very proud of at jsonline.com, both for home. I've got one for home runs, the included a list of the 25 best walk-off home runs in Brewers history, and then just a full-fledged database of all the walk-offs. There's like 377 of them. I greatly enjoy looking back at these every time we have another one. But, you know, with Daniel Vogelbach hitting a big home run, he, of course, has one of the 25 greatest walk-off home runs in Brewers history, at least according to me, when he hit a walk-off grand slam last year. It was the only instance in Brewers history when a hitter hit a walk-off grand slam down three runs. It's a pretty specific scenario, but just bear with me. Every run was required. It was a situation where the grand slam was the only thing that could have won the game in that moment. So that's true in Brewers history, but there was a moment back in 1976, April 10th. I don't know if you've heard this story, that is also on my list. It's number 25, the last on my list, the walk-off that wasn't. Don Money of the Milwaukee Brewers hit a walk-off grand slam. They were down three runs. It would have been the only instance before Vogelbach that happened. It came against Dave Pagán of the Yankees. So Money trotted around the bases, celebrated with his teammates. They were in the dugout. They were headed home. But then Yankees first baseman Chris Chambliss, he's saying that he called timeout before the pitch was thrown. So this is all developing as the celebration is going on. So Billy Martin, the Yankees manager, comes out, argues with the first base umpire, a guy by the name of Jim McKeon, says, you know what, we call time. And so the umpires discussed it, and they actually agreed. They said, yeah, okay, time was called, even though none of the Brewers said they heard or saw time called. The umpires decided it was, in fact, called ahead of time. So they bring everybody back out. Money flies out, so he doesn't drive in a run. George Scott drives in a run with a sacrifice fly, and that makes it 9-7. So the Brewers are still down 2. Daryl Porter grounds out. That's it. So the Brewers would have won 10-9. Instead, they lose 9-7. Just a crazy aftermath. You know, a lot of people were upset about it, as you might imagine. Harvey Keene, the first base coach, said he had never heard it or didn't see anybody yell. McKeon wasn't running toward the infield. You know, it was just this thing that developed after the fact. So a very controversial loss back in 1976. This is before, you know, just before the Brewers get really good. So it might not be the story a lot of people remember, but truly a crazy moment in Brewers history, even if it sort of predates the memorable era of Brewers history. But then Daniel Vogelbach took care of it, gave us the walk-off grand slam down 3 in the 2021 season. So a little history lesson there. Did you know about that? Had you heard that story?
I've heard it from you.
Ah, yes. Okay.
I think you'd very much like to tell that one. It's like that's a sneaky good one for like sports moments I wish Twitter was around for. I mean, could you imagine like Angel Hernandez being the first base ump at granting time and just how hard that would trend?
That umpire, oh my gosh, Kurt, you're absolutely right. That moment is made for Twitter.
I always love that prompt when it gets brought up. Like, what was a moment that you wish Twitter would have been around for? Everyone always says like Malice at the Palace. That's a very fantastic answer, but this one would have been underrated greatness.
It would have been incredible stuff. All right, let's wrap things up finally. Long one tonight, but let's wrap it up with Kurt Blanche. It's your take of the week.
Ryan Braun sends it to left center and deep. Get up! Get out of here! Gone! For Ryan Braun! He just hit a walk-off home!
Yeah, so, speaking of Twitter, a common argument that folks that are online have is around it, whether a hot dog is a sandwich or not.
Oh my God, we're going
I'm not going to get into that.
Okay.
I don't actually have an opinion on that. Although the answer is no, it's not a sandwich. It's not a sandwich. Nevertheless, there is a condiment that is best on a hot dog, as I discovered this week on 4th of July, you know, doing a very 4th of July thing and eating a bunch of hot dogs. It's hot sauce. Have you ever had hot sauce on a hot dog, JR?
Kurt, I do not eat hot dogs. I have eaten maybe 2 hot dogs in my life. I will not touch them.
This is right. You're like anti grilling out in general, though.
Yeah, you know, and we could talk about that later. Like, my stance has softened on brats. I'll eat brats. Not a lot of them, but I'll eat them. But hamburgers and hot dogs are not for me, Kurt. I've got no, gross.
Well, then I'm just gonna. This take is not for you. It's for the greater audience. I just trying to come up with, you know, a nice little baseball plus 4th of July week combo here. And I was having a hot dog and I decided instead of stadium sauce, which I normally do, and it's fine. on a hot dog. I like steak sauce, but it's just it doesn't elevate you know my food to the next level. Put some hot sauce packets on that thing, and I was, you know, just it surprised me
how intriguing
how it added a different profile, gets you. And maybe it was just because it was the first time, and I was a little taken aback by it. But if you, next time you have a hot dog, not you, JR, because you're never gonna have a hot dog, because I don't understand why. But that's your prerogative. But next time you're having a hot dog, everyone else, just put a little hot sauce on there. Even if you don't like hot sauce, just dab a little around the ketchup or the mustard or the relish or whatever, and be surprised.
All right, your condiment specialist, Kurt Hogue, coming at you with his take of the week. You can find more of his musings, presumably not just about condiments, at jsonline.com. He'll be in Minnesota. I believe that's you, right? Going to Minnesota for these games Tuesday, Wednesday. Is that correct?
That's right. My second two-game interleague series in like 2 weeks.
That's very right. Weird. Minnesota, a little different from Tampa Bay. But also then we've got four games in San Francisco before the All-Star break. Of course, you know, things will get going there Monday with the Home Run Derby on Monday. Tuesday is All-Star game, and then a couple more days off for the Brewers. They look to gear up for that second half. We'll still have a podcast, though. I've got some special guests lined up that I'm excited to share, but we'll certainly have one next week. We'll have a whole week of baseball to talk about, and then go from there. Kurt, thanks for joining me, man. I really appreciate it. It's been a long one here tonight, but thanks for chatting Brewers. We'll chat again very soon.
Yes, sir. A long one, but a good one.
Indeed. Find us on Stitcher, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Rating, review, but, you know, just find us on Twitter. Tell us what you think. I'm at JR Radcliffe. He's at Kurt Hogue. That's CYRTHOGG. And that sounded like a Snoop Dogg commercial for a second. We will love to hear from you, and we'll certainly get back to you. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.